Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fourth Age podcast's continuing coverage of the recap of The Gathering Storm. I, of course, am Andrew Gellis, and with us this episode is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be back as usual and looking forward to getting into this little section again. And with us also this episode, we have Spencer.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here. Like Andrew said, we're going to be continuing our recap of The Gathering Storm. This week we're starting with Chapter 5, and we're going until we decide to stop.
As you might be able to guess from the fact that we have now mentioned twice in this episode that we're going to be discussing The Gathering Storm, should be evident at this point that, good news, everyone, there's spoilers!
There certainly are. There will be spoilers not only of The Gathering Storm, but every single book in the Wheel of Time, including New Spring, and probably any other fantasy or science fiction novel or movie that you think of, because we range far wide, and we will try not to spoil anything for you, and we'll try to give you warning if we do, but be warned now, you may be spoiled.
So, Chapter 5, entitled A Tale of Blood, begins with a point of view by Randolph Orr. Rand crosses the green in front of the manor where Bashir's men have made camp. He's accompanied by Elza Penfell and Karel Hovian. He trusts Karel more than most, because she, Dahmer Flynn, and Samitsu has saved his life from the wound inflicted by Fane's dagger. The wound overlays the Shamails, of course, and the infections are fighting one another. Rand believes that it's one of those wounds that will spill his blood on the rocks of Shael Ghul. As he walks, he sees a vision of Matt tossing dice before some watching soldiers near a large road outside of a city. The small, dark-skinned woman that he saw in the previous vision is gone. A gateway opens on the traveling grounds. An Ashaman soldier has a message from Darlin that his army is ready in Tyr. Hurin and several other sea folk come through the gateway as well. Loghain mentioned that the sea folk were hesitant to return her to Rand. Rand, of course, complains that these ships are taking too long to arrive, but Hurin replies that the Shanchan caused the delays. Rand asks her what the sea folk do to men who can channel. They make a bargain that if she answers, he will answer a question of hers. Hurin says that they are killed or left stranded on a small island. Rand tells her that this must stop now that Sadyn is clean, but Hurin remains skeptical. Rand thinks that there might be another Jorlan Corbasan among those men. He was brilliant and ran the Sharom research facility in the Age of Legends, another memory from Luce Thuren. Rand thinks Luce Thuren will be able to help him figure out how to reseal the boar. Flynn comes through the gateway and apologizes that he is not as good at gateways as Andril. Rand then asks Elza what she believes about the taint, but she also hedges her answer. Karel says that she can feel through Dahmer that it is clean. Elza points out that during the time of madness, it took decades for people to be convinced that all male channelers would go mad. It will take a long time for people to really believe that that has now changed back and that Sadyn is once again clean. Rand thinks that he is bound by the pattern and has no choices. He wonders if he will leave anything behind but war and devastation. Last time, his madness and the grief at Delenya consumed him. He thinks of Moraine, telling him that we all do as we must. A guard brings news that there are Aiel near the camp. Rand sends orders to Bashir that they will be meeting with Balin Rark to secure the Arad-Daman. So, interesting point of view there. I like that we can place when Rand's vision takes place, because Tuan has left Matt's side and therefore is probably on her way back to Abu Dhar. So this is definitely after Matt's battle with Elbar's Shanshan force.
Yeah, and the fact that he's outside a city rolling dice with soldiers, it's brought up in the notes from Encyclopedia Walk that it seems likely that this vision is from outside Camelin, where Matt, we know, was headed after everything he goes through in this book, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it is, and I'm not even sure if that does make sense, because we know, we kind of know the Tuon outline of time throughout all this, and we know when she and Rand meet, and where that happens in the timeline. I'm wondering how long after she left Matt that was, if this point in time is Matt's already in Camelin.
That's actually a good point. It might be later in the book, but doesn't Rand at some point in time get a vision during the Gathering Storm of Matt walking down the street and somewhere, and he's like, I think Matt's in Camelin. I almost completely remember that, but I can't remember where it appears in the book.
Well, I don't remember exactly, but it sounds familiar to me, too. I think that scene sounds very familiar. I can't remember exactly what it was. But it does seem that the visions and the swirling color communications are getting more and more, you know, definite. They're not just a glimpse anymore. They're getting a lot of details and everything. And I just wonder when one of them is going to make the leap and try to speak to one of the other ones through the swirling colors.
I think part of that would have to be that the colors would have to happen jointly. It would actually have to coincide where both of them would be seeing the vision, because otherwise, you know, trying to talk to someone, you know, it's a little odd. It's like, I'm sitting down to write this person a letter.
I seem to remember that scene where he becomes aware of, I presume it was Moradin, and he thought, I think he says to Loyal that he thought that the other man was aware of him as well. And so I'm wondering if, as this grows stronger and stronger, if they will all get to the point where if one of them becomes aware of the other one, that the one to be viewed will actually, you know, have a sense of somebody of them contacting him, you know, and then it would just be a matter of give and take at that time, I think. I'm not quite sure how that would work, but...
Yeah.
But he definitely got that sense of the other man being aware of him, and if that's true, then they could possibly communicate.
Well, I don't know that the bond with Moradin... Rand has so many different connections to people going on in his head. I mean, he has four different warder bonds with the different ladies, plus the bond with Moradin, plus the bond with Matt and Perrin, and I think that all of them are distinct and different. And so I don't know that the analogy between his bond with Moradin, again, his bond with Matt and Perrin, I'm not sure how much we can compare those two. However, I do think that there has to be much more coming through this bond that the Taverin share for it to have a purpose in the story that Robert Jordan has written, because that's the way he writes, is it's always a more important than it first appears.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Aes Sedai thing that, yeah, the price is always less than you believe, but more than you could imagine. Something like that. I just feel like there's got to be something leading up for that. And I don't really think of these swirling colors issues as a bond. It may be a result of them both being Taverin or something else, but clearly there's no bond between Matt and Perrin and Rand and Matt, other than, I mean, and et cetera, between the three of them jointly and severally, other than bonds of friendship and being mutual Taverins on the road to Shael Ghul. But it isn't like a formal bond of the Leaves of the Power, you know, like the Water Bond or a Link Circle or anything like that.
Yeah, you're right. That is interesting. I never really had thought what it might mean before, but, you know, all the other bonds that Rand has, you know, with the Water Bonds plus the bond and the bond with Moradin, those were all created by the Power and using the Power. Or the true power, or both. as the case may be. But there hasn't been anything like that between him and the boys. So the question becomes, what's causing this kind of one-way communication here that's going on here? Almost spying, really.
Well, there is some sort of linkage, you know, between them. I mean, other than I don't recall Matt ever having had any visions in particular or dreams, but Aaron in the wolf dreams, you know, he would see those windows open up in the sky and showing him visions of what, you know, Rand was doing and what Aaron was doing, and even Nynaeve and Elaine one time, and I believe Amis were looking back at him curiously, wondering what he was doing, looking at them, kind of, and I don't remember Matt ever having visions like that, but there is definitely some linkage going on there. You know, at what point in time it's going to become an actual communication, if it ever does, is another question altogether.
Well, yeah, and you know that. Well, in that case, Matt's the only one that hasn't been in Teleron Riyadh. The rest of those, they all spend lots of time in the world of dreams. But it is interesting to think, though, that this bond that the Tavern have, rather than being kind of the first person bond that the Warder bond is, or even the bond with Moradin is, you know, it's very personal, very first person. This bond that the Tavern have is very third person. They don't see through the other's eyes. They see from the third person point of view, looking at them, and just does their consciousness, some portion of their consciousness escape and fly away, or because I could understand a bond, if they have a bond with the other Tavern, I could understand them being able to see through the other's eyes and maybe pick up on some thoughts. But that's not what happens. It's like they're transported to near the other one and allowed to a peek of what's going on. Which, in my mind, is much more interesting.
Something about that actually makes me think of some of Min's later visions. Like when, you know, Min looks at Nynaeve later and sees her kneeling over some man's body and being, you know, sad. It, you know, again, that's oddly third person. And I'm not wondering if, because this connection between them is, I'm assuming, based on their Tavernness, if it's not the reason that we get them in the third person is because it has to do with actually seeing the pattern as opposed to actually seeing them. So it's one of those things where, you know, the pattern is making itself available on a more omniscient level where you're actually able to grasp the skein as opposed to just the general where the immediate threads that are connecting you are.
Well, that's interesting. That's very interesting. I like that.
One of the other things in this segment that I really both kind of liked and hated, as much as that is possible, is the entire deal with Hareen. Because Rand, he makes a drastic accomplishment. He makes a bargain. He deals with them on the level of, I'm dealing with you on your level so that you can deal with me, and, you know, we're coming to an equitable arrangement, and he's making progress. And then, of course, you know, he hears about what's happening to men who can channel, and while I understand he's going to have an adverse reaction to, oh, what do we do with the men who can channel? We either dunk them over the side, or we drop them off on an island, which, incidentally, and kind of aside from the point, I almost assumed was the Isle of Mad Men, just because.
Yeah, so that's kind of a fair assumption.
How many islands can there be where they just randomly drop off all of the men who can channel, who happen all to be able to go insane?
Yep.
I mean, if the island is populated entirely by men, I somehow doubt they've been breeding there since the breaking. But, you know, he finds that out, and immediately he's like, I'm enacting Kuramur status. You will do this. You will make sure that they stop this process. And it's like, okay, you could have probably handled that in a way that would have, you know, led to, if not them acquiescing, to what you want them to do, at least opening the talks so that you can begin that process. I know Rand doesn't feel in the story like he has time for that, but a lot of things that Rand is working on are things that are possibly going to have to survive him.
I don't remember if it's in this book or if it's in an earlier one when the Aiel wise women are talking. You know, Rand is trying to act like a king to these people. And that only works with the Wetlanders. That only works with the people who are used to having kings in their lives. That doesn't work with people like the sea folk. That definitely doesn't work with the Aiel. That's not how their social system operates. And while he keeps trying to lead them like that, they'll roll their eyes and say, yeah, okay, you're this being of prophecy and promise, and okay, we'll play along with you because we have to. But you're right, just imagine what will happen after he's gone. He's no longer there to continue being this figure, and they're going to be like, okay, next, moving on.
And thankfully, Rand doesn't realize that at this point in the storyline, he is essentially a demigod. Because if he did, I think he would be just that much worse. I mean, he almost gets there later on, and we'll get to that in a different recap episode.
Yeah. I actually hadn't thought about Rand being a demigod, but you're right, he pretty much is.
Yeah, I mean, literally in his portion of the literary world, there are few who are going to match him for power. And, I mean, we do. We see him lose it a couple times over the course of this book and just basically do whatever he wants with the universe. I mean, it even gets to a point where it feels like he's not even channeling. He's just bending the pattern by willfully causing Taverin this stuff to happen. And I mean, it's just, it's kind of creepy.
And he won the cage match.
Yes, it's true. I will thank Brandon for his little write-up and explanation of why Rand should have won the cage match, because that did give me the impetus to be able to use the allusion towards demigodhood.
Even though there really isn't any place in the Wheel of Time philosophy or theology for any such creature to exist.
No, there isn't. I mean, there you have your creator and your destructor.
The creator, the dark one, the forsaken, and all the jailers.
Yeah, that's very much. It's very much a modernization. I want to almost say of the world, to make that a more modern metaphor for what he is than anything that they would be able to come up with in their. Because you're right, they don't have they don't believe in lesser gods, but
not even in their myths and legends.
No, nope, they don't. They have the creator, and then they have the creator, the dark one, and everyone else underneath. Going back though, I'm kind of interested about this. He makes this bargain with Hareen to. He'll give an answer, she'll give an answer, but so far, Hareen hasn't asked a question, and so we haven't gotten an answer. So I'm wondering, is that something that's happened off stage or off screen and we haven't seen it? Or what part is this going to play later in the books? I wonder if Cad Swain will steal her answer, make her ask a question for Cad Swain.
I just imagine at some point in time, Hareen comes up. Rand, you're not looking well. Are you feeling all right? Yes, that's one answer. Yeah, I don't credit Rand with being quite ingenious enough to come up with that.
Well, and I wouldn't credit her with being stupid enough to waste her question like that either. She is stupid, don't get me wrong, but I don't think she's that stupid.
So much stupid as she is willful and obdurate.
No, I mean, she has to be, because, remember, she's been, like, all visionized, too. It's yes, I know. I just created a word.
I like it.
She, Min's already told her stuff that's going to happen with her, and as a result, she's like, ah. So her two questions might actually be of great benefit to her in her rise as to the next Mistress of Ships.
It is kind of interesting to see more of the memory crossing over that we get between Rand and Luz Theron. I mean, we have the we have his remembering of an entire other person, this Jorlene Corbison. Corbison?
Yeah.
Probably Jorlene Corbison.
I think it's Jorlene Corbison, but that's me.
Yeah, probably Jorlene Corbison.
Not only that, but an entire research facility. Not only Jorlene Corbison, but an entire research facility. Yeah.
Yeah, he ran the Charon, which correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that the Charon was the floating ball that was suspended by the magnetic field in the Earth, not actually using any standing flows. But he ran this research facility, and the fact that that Rand is remembering enough of Luz Theron's life to be able to just randomly in thought just to say, well, I hope they haven't killed someone who could, you know, who's like another Jorlene Corbison who could be running our Charon. What?
Yeah. It's pretty darn specific, isn't it?
Very much so.
Yeah, but I mean, at least he's not making the mistake of just blurting it out to anybody nearby, you know, and then being like, come on, you remember him. Remember floating ball in the air? What's wrong with
well,
you?
Well, he did make the mistake of doing that back in chapter one when he's yelling at Luz Theron out loud in a room full of
people. In front
of
everybody.
Yeah.
That's sort of
but
like
in a way that,
in the old tongue.
That's at least, you know, something better than, in my opinion, than during the attack on the manor house in Ara Daemon, over in Tyr, when they're at the manor house and they've just fought off a giant thing of Trollocs, and, you know, Luz Theron snatches the power and he starts drawing in energy, and, like, I remember how I used to kill myself.
Yeah.
And, you know, and everybody's just kind of wondering, it's like, what are you doing? You know, it takes Loghain being there and being fortunate enough to go, you know what? He's holding a lot of the power. I mean, an awful lot. An amazing amount. An amount that's enough that I think I want to travel away from here very quickly.
So by the way, this guy looks like a nuclear reactor ready to explode.
I love what he said, though. I love what Loghain says. It's, yes, Rand, I know you're much more powerful than me. You can stop showing off now.
That's what he would do, right?
That's what I do. Well, no, probably not.
Not going to drag me bored anyway.
Mostly because I can't channel, but that's beside the point.
I feel that I would have a distinct urge to just kind of mention that I have no desire to be charcoal and then teleport away as fast as possible.
See you guys.
Well, to be perfectly honest, and I know that it doesn't. That this is kind of an interesting thing to bring up, because when you think about it, the traveling that we see in the prologue of Eye of the World is much different than the traveling we see later on in the book. But I think it would be much more interesting to travel by that form than to be going through the gateways.
Well, I want to know what would happen if an Ashaman like Loghain opened the gateway just as Rand is having this massive meltdown and drawing in more of the power than he can and creating the new dragon mount. Would that be like that scene in Stargate where they open the wormhole, you know, with the Stargate onto a wormhole? Not a good thing.
Yeah. Just randomly in the middle of a tier, there's a dragon mount. And then wherever he gatewayed to, there's even some more of the dragon mount. What? Well, you know, that's how it's going to have to be. Unless they relocate the Black Tower, he's going to have to turn Camelot into another dragon mount. Otherwise, they're going to be sad that they don't have their own huge mountain.
Oh.
No. See, dragon mount is, you know, right there near where the White Tower was founded. The Black Tower was founded in Andor, right next to the huge pit that they got from excising the Shadar Lagoth. Giant hole in the ground,
right.
Giant mountain.
That's
there
right.
You go.
Yeah, but then they have to move their whole Black Tower over there.
No, they're close enough geographically that they can claim. Yeah, you have your dragon mount. We get Shadar Lagoth. Get over it. Nah.
We got a giant crater. Hole in the ground.
We got our crater.
Hole.
It's cool.
Well, I thought they would rub it.
It has
right
water on it. Does your mountain have water? No. We have water.
I thought they'd just go right next to Dragon Mount and create one that's like 10 feet taller. You know, sort of like Elida's palace next to the White Tower. You know. Oh yeah, watch this. Ours is better. So moving along to Cad Swain's point of view. Cad Swain, Maurice, and Nerishma question Semirog in a small room. Arian, Serene, and Nasuni are outside the room holding her shield. Cad Swain is furious that Rand will only allow questioning of Semirog and not torture. I don't think they really wanted to torture him, did they? I mean, they just wanted to rough her up a lot, right? Never mind. Maurice asks about Grendel's plans. Semirog intimidates Maurice with a bloody tail so that she loses control of the session. Cad Swain stops the questioning, blocking Semirog's ears with air and her eyes with fire and air. Over 2 centuries ago, Cad Swain swore she would live to see the last battle. Cad Swain wishes that she had Forkroot to be doubly safe with Semirog. Maurice then composes herself and the questioning resumes, asking about Grendel and her whereabouts and plans. Cad Swain believes that Rand is destined to destroy the world. He may save it as well. But she's not sure which. Cad Swain thinks on how to break Semirog. Corell arrives with news that Rand is meeting with the clan chiefs and the questioning session ends. That's really short.
I don't know. As to the questioning instead of torturing thing, that I do think that there's a certain amount in which anyone getting a hold of the Forsaken who is not devoted to the Dark One themselves would kind of just... I mean, these people are monsters. They have done things worse than anyone else. And I mean, if anyone in the living world deserves, you know, to be treated in less than a pleasant manner, it's definitely them. So, I mean, I could understand channelers being like, you're responsible for a lot of the stuff that's gone on that has just totally bit in the last 2 years. Yeah, no, you get no privileges.
Yeah.
No slop a bucket for you. But at the same time, there is that questioning of, you know, well, as monstrous as they are still human beings, which, you know, you can almost question and almost not. So I don't know. I like Cad Swain's thoughts to herself as she, in this chapter and in later ones, runs through the ideas of, well, how do I break myself? Because in figuring out how I would break me is how I'm going to learn how to break her. And I like that Cad Swain is as self-aware as she is to realize that she shares a lot of characteristics with, you know, this particular Forsaken.
How scary is that, huh?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I have to say that I think that Rand's definition of what constitutes torture is really, I mean, I think he's lumping all kinds of things into the term torture that really wouldn't qualify. I think, you know, like Cad Swain doesn't pop in, she doesn't want to go after her like a white coat questioner with hot irons and needles and all that. She just wants to pressure on her. She wants to maybe make her uncomfortable, but I don't think they're going to just want to lock on fingers or just want to make her miserable enough to start talking to them. And, you know, whether that's psychological or whether it's physical, who knows what works with anyone until they try it, I guess. But I think that's the big gulf between Cad Swain and Nynaeve and Rand on that issue, and it will probably never be resolved any more than the issues have been resolved in our modern day headlines lately. Some people just think the least little amount of discomfort for a prisoner is torture, and other people think that anything short of physically maiming them is okie doke. You know, there's got to be a happy medium in between. I mean, you don't want to become as inhuman as Semirog in the process of trying to get something out of her. But then look at how, I loved what you were saying about Kathleen, you know, figuring out how to do it. I mean, look how she was ingenious enough to figure out that humiliation would work where physical punishment never would.
Even the humiliation that she put Semirog through would still be considered torture, but only because, but only to someone like Semirog, for whom it is torture. It is torturous to be humiliated to that extreme. However, that's not the battle line that Rand was drawing. Rand was saying, no, you can't hurt her because she's female. It wasn't even because she's human. It's because she's female. You can't hurt her. If it had been any of the male Forsaken, oh yeah, beat him up. He probably would have been doing the beating up. But no, because she was a female Forsaken, he could not condone the hurting of her because he has this wacko list in his head. Crazy.
Yeah, that's just me. I mean, I understand why he is the way he is, but I think he's so overboard with it. It's beyond reason. But then, you know, when you're questioning people, you know what the Joker said. Never start with the head. The victim gets all fuzzy.
Well, and we do know that Rand is kind of going loopy at this point, and he gets better eventually.
I know, but I think that I'm certain that the Forsaken's crimes are so heinous that anything short of outright torture is probably allowable. I mean, you can make somebody really, really uncomfortable without, you know, permanently damaging them in any way. And I think that sometimes, in extreme cases, it's probably necessary. Maybe not always. I mean, we're talking about something on the level of the Forsaken here. Okay, you know, make her wear underpants on her head. I don't care.
You do have to kind of keep in mind that the physical, like Andrew said, the physical torment wouldn't have fazed her at all. She would be able to deal with that without batting an eyelash. But you're right. It was the actual the mental torment, the mental torture that Cat Swain devised for her, the humiliation that was what would break her at the end. Now, to move off of Semirog a little bit, we do kind of get an interesting tidbit about Cat Swain here. I mean, we realize that Cat Swain is not young. We know that she's old as can be.
Oh, I don't think she's as old as Olivia.
No.
She's as old as an Aes Sedai can be. She has a 3-0. She can only get so old. But still, it is interesting to see that it's been 2 centuries since she promised herself she would see the last battle. Which I think it's interesting that that was put in there, because now I'm not entirely sure that it's going to happen.
No!
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
But in addition to that, I don't know my timeline well enough. I wish Jesse were here, because she could tell us exactly what year this chapter would be and the chronology. But we know that Cat Swain was thought to have been born around 705 New Era in Geldian, though. But she was born in Pharmadi. So we don't know whether or not the dates are right, which I would actually suspect they're not, because if I remember correctly, right now it's supposed to be like the 900 NE somewhere, and if she promised herself 2 centuries ago, 200 years ago, that means that 200 years ago she would have had to have been old enough to be able to make those kind of promises to herself, which I'm not sure she could do if she was born in the 700 New Eras. But maybe I'm looking at it too critically.
It's sort of like time travel. It just gives me a headache.
Well, I'm more interested as well as to what happened 200 years ago to make her give that promise. Something actually had to have happened that was significant enough to cause her to go, I need to live to see the last battle. In Eye of the World, didn't they make a comment about the fact that, you know, from the breaking of the world to the War of 100 years was nearly 1,000 years, and then from that to the, like, weren't they, like, making a reference, either there or in New Spring, where someone makes a connection between, it had to have been New Spring, as a matter of fact, it was in the preface, in the description of the Blood Snow.
There's a note at the end of the chapter on encyclopediawatt.org, whom we thank very much for the summaries that we are reading. It's encyclopedia-watt.org. And this is an interesting take on the prophecies, is that Rand will definitely break the world again, but will not necessarily save it. Then it's a little bit different. Usually people are pretty much sure it's going to be one or the other, or both.
I'm looking at a chronology now that I'm not entirely sure who has put together, but it's on StephenAC.net. I don't know who put it together, but apparently the opening bits of Winter Night are taking place in 998 New Era. 5000 New Era. We have lots of interesting things happening. Crossroads, Twilight, and Dreams. Here we are, Gathering Storm. So in 1000 New Era, around the time that... Okay, I'm reading through this now, so give me a second.
According to the timeline that I am looking at, which is a slightly different one, Kutswane's birth date is 705 New Era. And in 730 New Era, for the last time in her life, Cadswain encounters a situation she cannot surmount. In 794 New Era, two accepted are put out of the White Tower and form an organization known as the Daughters of Silence. They eventually recruit 23 other women capable of channeling to join their society. They're discovered 4 years later by Aes Sedai, and all are returned to the White Tower and punished. This is the last known gathering of female channelers to be broken by the White Tower.
Hmm.
Yeah, the one I'm looking at is just as actually during the course of the book. And so it actually has where Cadswain supervises the interrogation of Semrog by Maurice, which is what we just read. And that's about the middle of year 1000 New Era. So at this point in time, assuming that Cadswain was born in 705, she's now 295 years old. So,
which means, yeah, she is actually getting to the point where most older Aes Sedai eventually succumb to age.
Yeah. And I hope we don't see her die of old age. That would just be horribly terrible.
It would be both the best and the worst way to die as a Green.
Well, it would be the worst way to have Cadswain die, I think, is waning on a bed while the dragon is still preparing. She would go crazy. She would overexert herself and kill herself trying to meddle before she would actually die on the bed. But I have to wonder where, like it says, that she promised herself she would stay alive till the last battle. I can't see that happening now just because of the way it's been thrown out there in this manner. I'm trying to see what she would have seen during the course of her life. The Aiel War, definitely. Would she have been alive during the White Cloak? Yes, she would have been alive during the White Cloak War, too. But what else could have happened in there that would have given her this need, about the time that she was 95, to give her the need to I hope we find out. I hope that there is a very detailed chronology in the encyclopedia that Harriet and Team Jordan and the rest of Team Jordan are working on.
Yeah, the closest thing to 800 New Era that the timeline I'm looking at mentions are the last battles of the Consolidation in the Shanshan Empire. So, I mean, it doesn't really say that there's anything beyond Perennia, Damale, of the Grey Age being raised to the Merlin seat.
Where are you looking, by the way?
It is www.sevenspokes.com/chronology/3-NE.html.
Wow.
They've got a chronology, a calendar, characters, books, the world, the author.
So were you looking something up that you were going to add to that, Andrew, or are we just going to move on?
Oh, I just mentioned where we were, or where I was looking for the particular chronology.
Yeah.
Seems to be a rather nice little timeline. I haven't looked over the site in detail yet. The sevenspokes.com. It is a rather nice appearing chronology of the Wheel of Time world, and you can actually look at several different ages, including creation, first age, second age, third age, after breaking, the free years, the new era, and then it goes through each of the novels as well. So there's a lot there. There's a calendar segment and character segments. It's a nice little site that I just happened upon the other day.
Well, I think we should probably go ahead and move on to chapter 6.
All right, moving on to chapter 6, When Iron Melts. There's three POVs in this chapter. We'll probably do them in two sections. The first, though, is from Rodel Etralda. It's the evening after the paddle at Tharluna, making this about the same day as the fifth scene in the TGS prologue, which was the other Rodel Etralda point of view. So this is right after his point of view in the prologue. The battle is over. His forces were victorious, but over half of his soldiers are dead. The Shanshan were crushed against the walls of Tharluna. They have three times as many soldiers as Ane. Etralda finds General Turan, who is near death. Both of their blades are Heron Mark, and Turan is impressed with Etralda, but tells him that Thoroth cannot accept this failure. Etralda's tricks will not work a second time. Etralda understands that he will eventually lose, but he fights because he must. He cannot abandon his homeland, even though death is certain. Perhaps memory of his fight will spark rebellion in 100 years. Thoran asks for a quick death, and Etralda beheads him.
So I think that's this really interesting piece of character. His Etralda knows that he's going to die, that he cannot win this fight against the Shanshan. But he fights anyway because, as he says, he must. I love this kind of characterization that he has, that they all have, that is put into these things, this selflessness that all of these warrior types have, that I have to fight because, guess what, it's the right thing to do. I know I'm going to die, but I have to fight anyway.
Yeah, I was also impressed with just this general meeting between Turan and Rodel. Because there's this bond between the two of them, you know, and it's the bond that you can only have with someone who has led the charge against you in a battle, and it culminates with this nearly vague sort of almost seppuku-like reference. Where you're looking for a quick but at the same time honorable death. Just the idea. My memory is fading a little bit on this one, but I also remember there being something about the other general's sword, and I want to say that Rodel places it in the ground, basically like a grave marker.
Yeah, there really isn't that much in this point of view. Besides, we do get to hear Etralda talk about his strategy a little bit more in this conversation that he has with the other general, with Turan. And it's really interesting what Etralda was able to accomplish with 100,000 soldiers against at least 300,000 plus Damane. Still, he was able, because of the few weaknesses that the Shanshans had, he was able to exploit, and it's really interesting to see how he did that. Really, there's not much here. The interesting stuff with Etralda comes later.
Except I do want to say that I'm pretty sure that this is the new icon. This chapter had the new icon that came with Gathering Storm, the shattered glass, or the web. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that that was the new icon.
I'm fairly certain that the broken web, or whatever you want to call it, was definitely a new icon. I also kind of, it's really kind of odd, there's almost a poetry to Rodel's thoughts, and as he's, thinking about the battlefield, and he kind of compares it to the fact that no one writes, no historian writes what the battle actually is, and how there's just the mud and, you know, the mud that has been churned from, you know, men bleeding on the dry ground and just all the things, the horror of battle and how it never actually comes across unless you've lived it and been in it. Which I think is, like I said, again, it's just kind of another nod, I think, towards the fact that these characters are more than just, oh, so Rodel is a really smart guy, and he fought a battle and he won. Yay for him.
Well, yeah, that's a major theme, you know, throughout Robert Jordan's books, is that battle isn't just this big, glorious brawl that heroes go into to save the day. You know, it's death. It's this unsightly mess, the way he describes it, the pictures that he used.
I'm going to commit the cardinal sin and say that I'm pretty sure that this scene would have had to have been written by Robert Jordan. I don't think that Brandon would have been able to do this, simply because I know that there were experiences similar to this, military experiences that RJ had that Brandon hasn't. And so I think that kind of detail and that kind of, you know, the grit of the story is something that would have had to have been added by Robert Jordan, because without the life experience, those kind of life experiences, I'm not sure that Brandon would have been able to write it as well as he would have been able to write it, and he would have been able to write it well, but not as well as Robert Jordan was, who having had those kind of experiences.
Moving on to the next point of view, we have Leon Sharif. Egwene speaks with Liana in her cell in the lower levels of the White Tower. Liana truly believes that she is the Almohad now. Two yellow sisters, Misarin and Galarna, stand guard over Liana. As he starts to leave, the iron bars and stone floor of the cell begin to turn as soft as wax, and Liana begins to sink. Egwene screams for help, and the two sisters recover from their shock just long enough to pull her free with air. Egwene says that the Dark One is getting stronger and asks the two sisters what Elido's doing about it. Egwene tells Liana to stay strong and leaves. We then move on to Egwene's point of view, and as she walks back to the novice quarters, she unexpectedly runs into two brown sisters, Meonadrin and Nagain. Getting her bearings, she realizes that sections of the brown Arja quarters and novice quarters have switched. The Dark One's touch is becoming worse. Egwene entirely trudges off to bed. And that's it.
I was really prepared for something completely different when I saw the chapter title, you know, when Iron Melts. I had never really considered this idea that it's not like the stone of the floor and the bars, you know, heated up or something. It was literally that it just changed consistency from a solid to a liquid-ish type mass, you know, and you know, it's kind of creepy. And I've used that word like 3 or 4 times this podcast. It's kind of distressing that I can't find other words to use. it's really surreal that the you know, just the concept of suddenly the room starts oozing into where we don't really know. I guess a lower level of the tower. I mean, and it doesn't go back either. I mean, this is one of those. You know, I guess we can consider this might be a bubble of evil. Just a really distorted one. But you'll notice, like, they mentioned that there's, like, a divot in the floor that is still kind of, you know, looks like, you know, the stone had just kind of melted and ran. And it's just bizarre beyond all possible bounds. Like, maybe we should move you to a different cell.
Yeah, you know, well, I'm not sure if this was a bubble of evil. Because we had a similar thing happen with Matt while he was with Lucas' traveling show, and the random village that just suddenly starts melting into the ground. I mean, it's a random village in as much as it's a ghost town, literally, and shouldn't be there. But still, it just kind of melts into the ground, and the poor peddler who's there in the middle of town square and his horse and cart all start sinking as well.
I assume, just like Quicksand, they're just sucked under and they're basically buried alive, slowly.
Yeah, the only thing
painfully.
I would say about that, though, is that once the ghost town was gone, everything was as if the town just never existed. It's not like the earth looked like it had been disturbed or anything. As a matter of fact, the really unnerving portion of that particular episode is that the only sign that anything had ever been there was the farmer's hat just lying in the middle of the road.
Because for some reason it didn't get sucked under either, which is really creepy.
Yeah.
Again, with the creepy.
Yeah, so,
if it is a bubble of evil, though, I have to wonder. This is the second time,
or at least the second time that I can recall off the top of my head, that we've seen bubbles of evil attach themselves to the thread surrounding the Aes Sedai. It's interesting, because when we were first introduced to them, we were told that these bubbles of evil would kind of seek out and latch to the Taviran threads, because the Taviran were kind of like the drawing force for these bubbles. So I have to wonder whether someone in amongst the groups of Aes Sedai are Taviran, or whether it's just the fact that they can channel, or whether it's just the fact that they are ingrained so tightly with the three Taviran that they're close enough, if not in actual physical proximity, but their threads are close enough, tied in the pattern, or if there's just an abundance of bubbles and we don't see, and that's why we see them everywhere. But we don't, really. We see them much more often around the Aes Sedai than we have anywhere else.
Well, in that respect, it may... Now, I don't want to say it may have to do with something with channeling, because that doesn't make any sense, really. I do think that there just are a lot more bubbles now, with the seals continually being weakened and not many of them even being intact anymore. I have to imagine that more of that essence of, the Dark One is escaping. And it might not be a bubble of evil. I don't really know. I also was particularly impressed in Egwene's segment as she's walking. The thing that'll first tell you that the Brown Odge quarters and the Novice quarters have switched is that Egwene's paying attention to the floor tiles as she walks. I mean, she's so tired and she's just kind of zoned out. And, she's talking about how the tiles are going this color and then they suddenly switch to a completely different color. And it's not until she passes a couple of Brown sisters that she's like, wait a minute. Where am I again? And then, it was that really kind of, if you're reading really closely, you kind of catch the switch before Egwene does.
I'm just kind of wondering if bubbles of evil can travel along the pattern and be attracted by Taviran and presumably people that are just near and dear to the Taviran. Why can't bubbles of good follow along and burst somewhere near the good guys?
Because the good hasn't been locked out of the world and is trying to slowly encroach on it and bubbling through a bore in the pattern. Evil is.
Mm. Well, all evil is not in that thing. There will be some thing along.
Well, it's kind of, and this is different than the bubbles of evil, but I am thinking now of the influence that the Taviran have on chance and random and coincidence, random happenstance. Normally, what we've seen in books past is Rand comes to town, and all of a sudden there's this sudden onset of strange occurrences, good and bad. We have people who are randomly falling down flights of stairs. They get up and go on without a bump or scratch. Then we have people who trip over a paving stone and break their necks. We have increases in weddings, and we have increases in deaths as well, of old age or anything. But, it is interesting what you say, Virginia, because we see later on in the story that, and we don't need to discuss this in depth until it actually comes up, but we see later on where the random happenstance isn't good anymore. The increase in weddings, the increase of people falling out of four-story windows and getting up and going and playing with their friends or whatever, it's gone incredibly down, but the increase in the bad things is still accelerating like it had in the past. There is a lot of theories out there to why these strange things are happening. I mean, you think of the ghost town that melts away into nothingness, or the ghosts that they see that are in the village where Perrin goes to get supplies, or anywhere else, really, these strange occurrences. And, you know, a lot of the time, I know I had the drive to just attribute these to, the Dark One's breaking free and he's touching the world and he's causing the dead to walk out of their graves, he's causing the weather to go crazy, and all of this. But there are some really provocative theories out there that present other ideas, including the fact that because the land and the dragon are tied together as one, you know, Rand is constantly being haunted by memories of his past, or his past lies by the dead who have risen in his brain. You know, he's with this infection that he's fighting, his bodily temperature is usually higher than it should be, and other such instances that come along. And this in addition to the bubbles of evil that are floating around. Chaos is reigning supreme in their world right now. And I think last chapter, the revelation on Dragonmount will do a lot to help relieve a lot of the burden that you just have to assume is on the pattern right now, because chaos is not that. It's the pattern is built for order. Chaos is the Dark One's ultimate goal, I think.
I do agree that the way the web is becoming increasingly more chaotic, the weave of the pattern is being introduced to a higher ratio of discord, and it is very prominent, and it leads towards it is all pointing towards the last battle. So, moving on to Chapter 7, The Plan for Ara-Daman. In the manor house, Nynaeve and Daigon are talking. Nynaeve feels that there is a terrible storm coming. Daigon does not treat Nynaeve as a full Aes Sedai, even though Egwene has raised her and Elaine to the shawl, and as a consequence, she is teaching Nynaeve the weaves for the test for the shawl. Daigon and the other sisters with Cadswain do not openly support either Egwene and her rebels or Elaida in the White Tower. Daigon still feels the loss of her warder, Eben, but she will not allow an attempt at healing. When Nynaeve, is incredulous at this, she and asks why she wouldn't want to be healed. Daigon asks her if Nynaeve herself would wish to be healed of her grief if she lost Lon. Hrell suggested the lessons, as a matter of fact, because it would provide a distraction for Daigon. Nynaeve is glad the access key that she had used during the cleansing of Sidon has been destroyed. It's too much power for any one person to wield. She is glad that Cadswain will not let Rand have access to the male access key either. Nynaeve sees Cadswain and Kurel crossing the courtyard purposefully and hurries to join them. She sees a male Aiel and realizes that the clan chiefs have arrived. She wonders if Avienda is with them. She thinks Rand still gets into trouble, like he and Matt used to back in Emmons Field. She regrets Moraine taking them away, but knows they would be dead otherwise. She goes to the largest Aiel tent, where she finds Rand, Bashar, and men with guards. She wonders if Rand is insane, as Semirog implies. She thinks it is a mistake to be holding Semirog after her experience with holding Mogadian and then losing her. Cadswain and Kurel enter. Nynaeve refuses to respect Cadswain's age, as she thinks that old Sanbiri is a very elderly man and consequently has the sense of a pile of rocks. Others enter, including Maurice, Narishma, and Maurice's other warders, Dahmer Flynn, and Elza Penfell. Finally, Rark and Bale arrive with Avienda and other wise ones, including Amys, Bear, and Melanie. Rand unfairly chides them for not restoring order in the Ara-Daman yet. Bale says that Dobraine Tarbrawin has Bandar-Iban under control. But Al-Salam and the Council of Merchants have disappeared. Rand thinks that Grandel may have the king, and says they must bring peace and stop the fighting against the Shanshan in order to show good faith for his meeting with the Daughter of the Nine Moons. Rand will personally, he claims, deal with Rodel Itcherald. He orders Rark and Bale to find and hold the members of the Council of Nine, which in Aiel custom goes against their rules of combat and other personal interactions.
You know, I just kind of want to point out this thing that's really interesting, that finally kind of sort of seen it come to light here. It really becomes kind of important later. Going back to the prologue of the Knife of Dreams, where Rodel Itcherald is thinking to himself that he has a plan for every contingency, except if the Dragon Reborn himself were to pop up in front of his face. He doesn't have a plan for that one. Which, at the time, when he was thinking, it was like, oh, yeah, this is this way wacky. Yeah, I have a plan for everything, except, you know, yeah, the Dragon Reborn shows up. Yeah, maybe I can't plan. Which is going to happen now. We see it. We see Rand's planning on going to talk to him. He's planning on popping up in front of his face. And I just think it's fun to see these things finally come into fruition.
Yeah, Robert Jordan did that, actually. I mean, I think the most famous ones were several times he mentioned either somebody thinking it, or at one point in time the girls even tease each other. I think Moraine sees Egwene running around with Rand in Shinar and thinks if that girl has half that initiative, when she gets to the tower, she'll be the Amyrlin someday. And the girls are teasing each other, oh, well, you'll be queen when I'm Amyrlin. Ha, 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 like that's going to happen, sort of. Attitude, you know, and it just finds me, what a surprise, it happens. You know,
the only person who isn't surprised by it is Min.
Yeah, exactly. She's not surprised by much anymore, is she? What happens if Min is surprised? I guess we really got to worry.
Well, she gets surprised by the viewing, by what she sees is going to happen, but she's not surprised when it does.
So anyway, he does a lot of foreshadowing like that. There were a lot of other instances, too, with the boys and so forth.
Yeah, but I remember we said then when we were doing the read-through of the prologue, we're like, yeah, this is so going to have to happen now, because he said it. He said the magic word, so it's going to happen.
Yeah, it's like going into a battle and showing somebody a picture of your wife and kids.
They're dead. Red shirt.
Yeah, the infamous red shirt.
So, actually, that reminds me of something. Speaking of a person who is almost a red shirt, why is Daigian treating Nynaeve so crummily? I mean, you would think, having been treated as the most insignificant person in the room her entire career as novice, accepted, and Aes Sedai, that Daigian would have a little bit more, you know, sensitivity to not pull that same routine on somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, at the same point, we know that it's happening, even though they don't, you know, openly show it. I mean, she's just lost a warder, and that, we all know, is a terrible, terrible strain. We don't really yet know if that sort of feeling is compounded by having a warder die who is a man who can channel. There may be a, you know, a stronger bond or a difference in the bond, the warder bond, through that, and it might actually have a greater impact on her. I mean, she might just not be herself at all, whereas she might be more naturally inclined to, or it might just be the idea that if you've been the, you know, low totem on the pole for, you know, the past who knows how many decades, you know, and then there's suddenly this young woman who's like, I was raised to the, you know, to Aes Sedai, and I'm totally stronger than you, and I am awesome, and I can heal you from your pain, because that's what I do, because I'm a yellow. You know, then suddenly out of nowhere, it's like, you know what, kid, sit down and learn your freaking test. Because I'm not going to acknowledge you as being an Aes Sedai until you've taken the test and sworn the oaths to sit down and take it.
And done all 100 of these stupid weeks in order, exactly right.
I just want to see one of those weaves turn out to actually be useful before the last battle. I think that'd be great. Yeah.
I just want to see Nynaeve and Elaine go through the actual test with Cat Swain running it in the room.
Oh,
that would be interesting.
You are brutal.
It'd be worse than Elida. It'd be way worse than Elida.
Yeah.
I think with Nynaeve, they'd melt the Tarangriel.
No doubt. No doubt. The thing would go spinning through the floor. On its way to Tara.
I'm a little confused. I've only gotten through the 65th weave, and suddenly everything just says tilt.
Well, it's like somehow the Wonder Girls figure out this could be interesting. They like go in, they do the first 10 or so, then they step into their next one, and they're suddenly done. Wait, what?
Hey.
The judges need to review the replay. After reviewing the replay, we judges have found that the last weave was not completed correctly, and yet somehow it still resulted in her being done. Apparently, when done this exact wrong way, it's actually a shortcut.
It's a shortcut to create a time warp. You've actually developed a weave to create a time warp, which allows you to do all 45 of the additional weaves in 32.26 seconds.
It's just a jump to the left.
I was thinking,
and then a step to the right.
I don't know. All these.
Well, no, it's just the Tarangriel, and any and every Tarangriel can be manipulated to make it do what you want it to do. So if you weave at it correctly, even while you're inside it, I'm sure that there's a way to skip to the end. Okay, this is boring.
Sure.
Skip.
Got it. Elaine sneaks in and studies the Tarangriel that they use
with
to Avienda. Do the test.
With Avienda.
Yeah, with Avienda, and surreptitiously makes a complete copy, which causes the exact same weaves to be performed in a fraction of the time, but leaving the watchers with the impression that all of the tests has been completed just as exactly as normal. But she only had to tweak it a little bit to do that.
I honestly think that the length of the test is arbitrarily decided by the Aes Sedai. I think they just chose 100 weaves because they figured that's how long they would need in order to determine whether or not someone was worthy of being an Aes Sedai or not. And as a result of that, I totally think that literally they probably could step in, go, okay, when you see this thing, just throw out all 100 weaves at once and we'll say that you passed. It'll be great.
Yeah, well, you know, the 100 weaves is kind of odd. When you look at the Wheel of Time numerology, if I may, normally not in base 10. Normally, it's actually base 3. You have your 12s and your 3s and your... Well, I guess you have your 13s, too, which are weird. There's lots of 13s. There's apparently 13 months in the calendar year. I didn't realize that. But, but there's lots of 12s, there's lots of 13s, and there's lots of, there's more 13s than 12s, I think. But there's lots of 3s. So why are they suddenly 100? 122 I could accept. 99 would actually make more sense than 100 when you're looking at the Wheel of Time numerology.
But I actually forgot to tell you when I was letting my little scenario past you that after Egwene went in and tweaked the Tarangriel, it suddenly became named the Kobayashi Maru. And she had an apple while she was taking the test. She was totally munching on an apple while she was taking that test.
We kind of got caught on Aes Sedai tests and Iteralda being about to experience some unpleasant things.
There was a really nice thing with Avienda finally showing back up. We don't really get a whole lot we do know that, you know, she's been doing stuff, and obviously she's in the earlier chapters, right?
Yeah.
Actually, she does have a point of view.
Yeah, there's that entire thing about, you know, not understanding what she's doing wrong beginning, which, yeah. But no, it's nice that, you know, we get to see someone not Rand wondering about where Avienda is. And, you know, coming from Nynaeve, it's kind of nice, too, because, you know, she's not been as connected with the people close to Rand and the other girls in the same way. I mean, since book one, Nynaeve's always kind of been in her own little echelon in one way or another. And so it's kind of nice that she's like, oh, you know, I wonder if Avienda's going to be with them. And lo and behold, there she is.
I'm still surprised continually that Nynaeve's made so many strides. She's grown up so much as a person, and yet she still has these annoying lapses into this sort of time warp Nynaeve, and where she still thinks of Rand as getting into trouble like he and Matt used to in Emmons. It's like, ugh. And she's still, you know, still moaning like a sheep about more taking them away. I mean, she's accepted the fact that they would have died if she hadn't, but she's still whining about it. It's like she's grown so tremendously in some areas, and yet she's still, you know, basically got some arrested development in some of these others. Kind of disconcerting.
Yeah. Well, and I love the great maturity that she shows when it says that she's not going to respect Cad Swain's age because she's dealt with Senwyn Bui and he's dumb as a box of rocks. I mean,
yeah.
So we know that old people aren't wiser. I mean, the fact that she's lived for almost 300 years doesn't mean a thing.
Yeah.
For heaven's sakes.
Yeah, she still really hasn't gotten over that whole age thing. I mean, wishing for her gray hairs and all that stuff. It's like, oh, come on, I mean, would you please just move on? Your eyes to die. Just get over it.
Well, I mean, honestly, with Nynaeve, I've never understood that concept in her of like, oh, what I wouldn't give for, you know, my gray hairs. And it's like, you're powerful and, you know, you're an Aes Sedai. Just tell the person, look, yeah, I look young. Deal with it. I mean, come on.
Yeah, you're powerful, you're young, you're beautiful, and now you want respect because you're... Oh, excuse me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't work with me either.
She needs her stick back so she can just hit people with it.
There's a moment that didn't get covered in the plot summary here, too, that I really liked, and that Nynaeve shows up in the Aiel tent, and Rand looks up, and he says something very offhand about, oh good, now I won't have to send anyone for you. It was really one of those things where it's like, you know, he is kind of really taking having Nynaeve there as something that is noticed and official, which is, you know, it's not just that she's hanging around for the sake of, oh look, there's somebody I knew from when I lived in Emmons Field. You know, the fact that he at least implies that he values her input.
It's interesting where she's wanting and trying to continue to act as a nursemaid to these boys, he's very much trying to treat her as an advisor. And if she would act the way that he needs her to, rather than the way that she wants to, she would get a lot more respect.
Oh, yeah. No.
Yeah.
From everyone,
yeah,
including me, you know, and I think a lot of readers who have that tendency to hate her.
I think she muses in the next chapter that she's upset because she doesn't have your respect, Spencer, actually.
And but no,
she does something to earn it.
Then she goes back into the same old, just like, well, how sane is Rand right now? And,
yeah,
you know, how much can we believe Semirog? And it's like, well, you roll the dice, you take chances. I mean,
yeah. Okay,
that depends on how good a day he's having.
Yeah, right. Depends on how good a day he's having. Can't she delve and tell something about his sanity? Is that only for the physical?
Well, the problem there is that, and they mentioned this a lot earlier in the series, is that working with the mind is really difficult, particularly because of the fact that a lot of weaves, you have to be able to see the thing you're affecting. And, you know, without cracking the person's skull open and going, gray matter, there's no real way to do assuredly the concepts of, okay, well, I'm going to go in and perform complex neurosurgery on someone using the power because I don't know what the brain really looks like.
Well, it's the same for all healing of internal things, though. I mean, when they do delvings to check the body, they can't see the heart or the lungs. Most of them probably haven't ever seen a autopsied body, you know. They haven't seen all the internal organs. So I think the major difference is that the mind is much more complex than any other muscle structure. The brain has just thousands and thousands of neural passageways and electric arcs or whatever. I don't even know. I'm not a neurosurgeon. I know basic human biology and anatomy. And by basic, I mean really basic.
I'm losing it. I'm thinking of the Terminator. I have some files on human anatomy.
Oh, dear.
I'm sorry. No neurosurgeon can see everything that's going on in the brain either. They're all operating on stuff, and they can't see the neurons firing, or they can't see the abnormal thought patterns forming or anything like that. So I think that the Aes Sedai healing would affect the system rather than the physiology, you know, per se, the nuts and bolts of it. I mean, like you said, when they're healing, they're not going in there and looking, oh, there's the heart beating. Oh, look, there's a blockage. No, they just go in and they delve it, they feel that something's wrong, and they fix it, you know. I think it's more intuitive than mechanical, personally.
But in the case of, you know, Rand, too, at this point, you can very safely say that he has two dissociated personalities in his brain. You know, how do you heal what isn't necessarily a schism of the same brain, but two fully formed and distinct personalities?
Well, it was very difficult. You have to reintegrate them. She said it was very difficult. You had to reintegrate them, and it was extraordinarily difficult to achieve, even for her.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's something that you could have just healed, but I do have to wonder, you know, along these same lines, what would Nynaeve do to heal Daigien of her grief, of her lost ward?
I don't know. Do they have, like, a Prozac weave or something?
Well,
no, I don't know, because what is there to heal? There's nothing. This is heartache. This is heartbreak. This is an emotional state. You can suddenly influence the emotions of others with your healing weave. That's not safe.
No, well, I think that's exactly what they do, yeah.
Well,
I think they heal the systems. They heal the systems, not the physical problems.
What I'm also guessing might be the case.
Dude, it's magic, okay? Get over it. it's a magic system. It works because I said so.
No, I mean, I'm guessing that when Nynaeve is offering to heal her, Nynaeve is seeing the warder bond and the connection to Sadar and Sadon being very similar, and that if something is broken when you are severed, then obviously something is broken during the death of a warder. And that there might actually be a way to repair, in some ways, some end of the damage that was done when that bond was severed.
You're probably right.
But I don't know, because obviously we've not really seen a great profusion of women healed from anything other than stilling or just regular injuries.
Yeah.
I mean, the weirdest thing is, and I almost, because Nynaeve, when she healed Samwan, that's when Samwan became aware of Ulrich's death. That's like when it really hit her. Which, you know, you would think that if Nynaeve had further delved, it would have been like, oh, well, there's also this thing.
Well, I think that also gives us a clue to what happened with Moraine and Lan. There was a severing of the bond because of the dislocation in time and space that happened but does that mean that the same sort of thing is going to happen when, and I presume it's going to be when and not if, Moraine re-enters the physical world and leaves the land of the Finns? Is her water bond to Lon going to be resurrected in some respect? Again, Vivian, no, probably not, because she passes to Morel.
Yeah, no, what I'm assuming happened there is that in falling through the doorway and the doorway melting down, because you'll know Lon didn't go with Moraine into the doorway in Tyr. So, you know, Moraine would have gone into the world of the Finns then.
Why didn't she take him?
No steel, no blah, blah, blah. Also,
That guy's more deadly with his bare hands than 10 guys with steel on their hip.
Yeah, no, what I'm assuming, and I meant iron, but what I'm assuming is that through study, it doesn't appear that even if you walk in the doorway at the same time, that you end up in the same place. I think those doorways treat each person going through it as if they were shunted into their own sub-universe.
Yeah, folded reality, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm guessing that the Tower of Genji is the only way that multiple people could enter at the same time and not be completely alone, unless... dot, dot, dot.
And now, this.
Well, it looks like that'll pretty much wrap up this particular episode. If you see anything that we missed, if you have any constructive criticisms, feedback, comments, suggestions, crazy theories, we're always, always, always glad to hear from the listeners, and you can get a hold of us in a variety of ways. First and foremost, you can call and leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
And you can also email us at podcast@dragonmount.com or leave comments on the podcast pages. After each episode, there is a comment section.
And those you can find at our homepage, which is dragonmount.com/podcast. And like Virginia said, you can find all of our old episodes there, comment after each one. Also on dragonmount.com in their forums, you can find the Fourth Age forum that needs to be used. People, get out there. Start using it. It's there. It's a great resource.
There for you.
If you do not live in the United States or you cannot use the toll-free number or you don't want to, either way, you can always record yourself, create an MP3 file, and email that to us. That is a perfectly valid way of getting your voice heard on the air. We need to thank Encyclopedia Watt, who provided most of the material for the summaries for each chapter, and also notes were pointed out that made good conversation pieces. And we want to thank Bob Klutz, who is the editor, and Gary Kephart, who is the webmaster of it, and then everyone who's contributed to Encyclopedia Watt. And let's see, who else do we need to thank before we're done here?
Jason Denzel, our host at dragonmount.com.
And lots of others. So we got all of Team Jordan and Brandon, obviously. We got dragonmount.com. Josh Needleman, the artist who created the music for us, that you'll hear in a few seconds. And then all of you who continue to listen to us, you crazy, crazy people, thank you.
We love you. Until the next episode, and we meet again, this is Virginia, hoping that you will walk in the light, and the light may illumine you until we meet again.
And until next time, may you find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gellis, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravian and Domar Shima, Tai Chi Te.
Going back, though, I am kind of interesting. Interesting? Yes, I'm very
interesting.
Very interesting. Thank you very much. No.
Yes, you are. I balefire your crickets, sir.
That's the new sound of balefire, I guess. I don't know.
Well, that's definitely what would happen if you were killed with crickets with balefire, yeah. sort of like getting an ant with a hammer, you know.
Although Spencer's, "Huh, we got water. Does your mountain have water?" No. Was awesome.
No.
Cimarron turned me into a newt.
This is what happens when we wake Virginia up. She goes into crazy mode.